it to the river, but really continue to push the river of what it can be. So thank you very much for your leadership on that. Of course, with your team. Let's go ahead and do introductions, but I do want to, I can just take a little bit of a privilege here, do want to personally welcome Christophe Toulouse, who is now with EPA, and Christophe, you'll have to give the full title again, but I know it's part of the President's executive order focusing, including on the Anacostia River in the Bay, and my predecessor, one of the few folks that ever knows what it means to be a state, a county, and a city leader in the environment, all in one. It's an interesting position to be in, and certainly, you know, you did a lot of great things for our city. And so it's wonderful to see you here. So we will go around and introduce ourselves, and we'll start with Michael Stevens.
Good afternoon, Michael Stevens with the Capitol Riverfront Good.
Christophe Toulouse, and I don't think I need to say another word. All that's left is you need to serve on the Supreme Court, I think.
We get the judiciary out.
I'm Ben Grumbles, Secretary of the Environment for the State of Maryland.
Jim Foster, Anacostia Watershed Society. Good afternoon.
Jeff Seltzer with DOEE Stormwater.
Michelle Capolis with the Council of Governments.
Jeff Johnson, Department of the Interior for the National Park Service.
Casey Padgett, Interior, Council for National Park Service.
However you want to do it, I can provide, we can provide direction from here. Well, let's go straight back, Wesley, and knock the back rows out.
Wesley Rosenthal, Assistant General Counsel at DOEE.
I'm Dave Dickman, I'm General Counsel at DOEE.
Ben Morali, DOEE.
Mark Shue, Project Manager of PetroTech, supporting DOEE.
Rebecca Swaller.
Chris Laskowski with DC Appleseed.
Doug Siglin with the Anacostia Waterfront Trust.
Gretchen McKeska, DOE Anacostia Coordinator.
I'm Carlton Ray, I'm Director of the Clean Rivers Project for DC Water.
I'm Maureen Holman, Sustainability Chief for DC Water.
Walter Smith, DC Appleseed.
Chris Weiss, DC Environmental Network.
Emily Frank, Anacostia Riverkeeper.
Lisa Felt, Director of Montgomery County Department of Environment.
Walls, Department.
And then, do we have anyone on telephone that is called in?
Yeah.
Okay, identify yourself.
Glenn Ogilvie, Center for Nonprofit Advancement.
Welcome.
Tommy, this is John Capicazzi, EPA Region 3 Water.
Very good. Anybody else?
It's Simeon Hahn from NOAA.
NOAA, very good. Anyone else? B-Matt, you want to introduce yourself?
Thank you, sir. Bill Matuszewski, DC Vice Chair of the Citizens Advisory Committee on the Anacostia River.
Okay. So next on the agenda, let's get an update of where we are on the Anacostia River Sediment Project. And as we, as you come up, Mark, let me, and I've said this before, but let me just say that a lot of the citizens don't understand that the city owns the water and the National Park Service owns the riverbed. And the partnership is so critical on this that we're not going to be able to move forward without a strong partnership. And seeing our friends from the National Park Service here, and especially with the legal team, working with our legal team, it has been, I want to assure everyone at the table, there's been no slowdown. In fact, I think we've actually made up time and speed because the partnership's been terrific, seamless. When we do work together, it's not from one to the other, it's together. And I cannot say enough about that partnership because we're gonna have to have that when we move forward with the record of decision. Getting the sediment cleaned up, but I want to just update everyone that that partnership continues to be a remarkable one that I'm very pleased to speak to. With that, Mark.
Well, thank you, Director Wells. I am Mark Shue, and I am a TetraTech Project Manager, and TetraTech is supporting DOEE in the Anacostia River Sediment Cleanup Project.
So just to get everybody on the same page about the project, this is just a slide showing our study area. It is the tidal river from Bladensburg down to the Potomac confluence, and we include the Washington Channel and Cayman Lake. We've got 15 potential environmental cleanup sites that border these bodies of water. They're all listed on this figure. I won't name them. Those are sites that may have contributed contamination to the sediments of the river. And we also have in this tidal portion of the river about 90 outfalls. Those are combined sewer outfalls and storm sewer outfalls, and there are 14 tributary streams. So it's a pretty complex study area. This slide kind of shows at a glance of the whole multi-year project that we're in and where we are in each task right now. Really, at a grand view, there are three tasks, three project phases. It's the remedial investigation, the feasibility study, and then we're going to create a proposed plan about the best way to clean up the river. The remedial investigation is all about defining the problem, sampling, determining where the contamination is, what contamination is an issue and needs to be dealt with. And then the feasibility study is what kind of technologies, what can we do to remediate those sediments that pose a risk to human health or the environment. Now, as you can see from the slide, we're in the waning stages of the remedial investigation, and we're ramping up the feasibility study right now. And in the rest of this talk, I will be kind of giving you a status of each of these stages, starting with remedial investigation. So we started the sampling for the remedial investigation in the summer of 2014, and we sampled in 2015. And that kind of culminated in a phase one remedial investigation report that was issued for public comment in March 2016. And based on the conclusions of that report, we identified various data gaps that prompted us to need to go out and sample again, which we did in the summer of just this past summer. And these are some of the data gaps that we had to address. At those cleanup sites, we don't really understand, we didn't really sample near there, so we had to sample near those cleanup sites in the river. Bed load, the outfalls and the tributaries I mentioned, we don't have a good understanding about what's the contaminant load from that. Surface water, we saw some trends in the surface water that may indicate point source, but we don't know for sure. So we have to go back and sample to see if that's actually the case. And in terms of the biota in the river, there were a lot of issues. There are a lot of data gaps for us to address. With regard to toxicity to benthic invertebrates, to fish, and so on. We did that sampling. And then there were, even though we did a pretty extensive fish tissue sampling effort in the first phase, phase two, we need to go back and get better background to compare the river to. So we did that. And last but not least, we needed to gather hydrocarbon forensic data from the sediment that will enable us to actually go and identify specific sources. So we have these 15 cleanup sites, we have these outfalls that have contaminants, but we need to sample that for this specific suite of chemicals that allow us to say this site may have contributed or probably contributed to this. This site did not. So it enables us to do that. And some of this is ongoing, and I'll touch on that as I move forward. What I'm going to do now is just go through some of these data gaps and the sampling we're going to do just to give you a feel for what we did this past summer. We don't have any data back yet, so all we can really do is say what we did. But it will be documented in a phase two report to be released. Starting with surface sediment, what the map on the right shows is what the sampling we did in 2014, the phase one sampling, that's in those red dots. And the blue dots are what we just did last summer. And the phase one sampling was really biased away from those cleanup sites. So in phase two, to get a total picture of the river, we had to go back, actually just a little aside. That was in hopes that cleanup sites themselves would do their own characterization, which they did not. So that prompted us to go back and fill in those gaps. And you can see where a lot of those dots around the gray areas there. We
We also had to do some surface sediment sampling to support our ecological characterization. This was all done, and this has been completed. I should say that surface sediment, when we talk about surface sediment, that's the top 6 inches. That's it. That's all we're looking at. This slide shows subsurface, the deeper sediments. That's a half an inch or a half a foot below the river bottom to the base of geologically recent sediments. So all the soft sediments that are included there. These are cores. They can go to like 10, 12 feet. Again, we focus this sampling in around the cleanup site, so that's kind of what the map shows. With regard to the biota and the fish, this sampling, if I could summarize it, would be that we really wanted to sample various representative animals from the food chain, from benthic invertebrates to crayfish, to turtles, to get a better idea of the contaminant distribution within the food chain, within the whole food chain. There's kind of a data gap there. So this turtles have no predators over the top. Crayfish are kind of intermediate, and these clams are down at the base. So we collected a variety of samples here. We also we had a data gap in terms of the toxicity of whole sediment in the river to the bottom of the fish. So what you can see in this one slide is actual sediment from the river with river water. Those are larval fish, and so we're looking at both survival of those. As I indicated, the data gap was with the outfalls and their contributions. We have written a work plan. It's draft. It's under review by DOE and NPS. We hope the field work kicks off before the end of the year, and what it entails is actually mapped the, looked at outfalls, daylighting in this river, identified manholes, and the object of this task is to sample those manholes, go up above tide, get a sample of bottom sediment, test it for those forensic constituents, characterization, and see which outfalls are likely a match to the river. Tributaries, again, same deal as the outfalls. These tributaries, these 14 streams, are the conceptualization that we have is, during storm flow, there's a lot of suspended sediment that gets delivered down to the river. And all of the constituents that are the key contaminants in the river glom onto that sediment. So you really don't have, we know this, this is pretty much understood, but we haven't measured it. So this task, which is being done by USGS in cooperation with DOE, we're going to look at the major tributaries, these three right here that I indicate, Northeast Branch, Northwest Branch, Lower Beaver Dam Creek, and six smaller tributaries, and we're actually going to collect samples of the sediment that's entrained in the water during storm and test it for our contaminants. Now, that work is ongoing, that plan, that work should start before the end of the year. So that's kind of the remedial investigation in a nutshell, and this is turned towards the other big phase of the project, feasibility study. And that's, as I say, kind of ramping up. We're right now in the initial phase of that, which is kind of doing preliminary identification evaluation of our remedial alternatives. So that's going on. We're developing a very comprehensive surface water model for the whole study area, plus the Potomac as a boundary condition. You can see in this figure on this slide where that study area is. That's a model that includes the loading that will simulate the loading from the tributaries and simulate contaminant transport in the tidal river, so we can evaluate different remediation approaches and whether they be affected by storms, for example. We will be updating our ecological risk assessments because those feed directly into the remediation
action objectives and preliminary remediation goals, which are kind of the foundation for the feasibility study, which will allow us then to complete these tasks that we will finalize those objectives. We will conduct a detailed evaluation of alternatives, and this will lead to the establishment of our remedy, final remedy, and then the proposed plan. So, in a nutshell, that's the status of the project.
Questions for Tetra Tech? Lisa?
With regard to the surface water modeling, are you going to get that peer review, or have you used the model that you're actually going to use?
It is going to be a attachment to the the phase two report. So it will be publicly reviewed. It will be reviewed that way. We are also working closely with the district's other consultant, LimnoTech, and they're involved with it. They're reviewing as we meet with them and present what we're doing.
I would urge a peer, more formalized peer review process of these models, having kind of gone through this in other jurisdictions. So.
Okay.
Thank you, Lisa. Mr. Grumbles, Secretary Grumbles.
Just a question about the tributaries. Intergovernmental cooperation and coordination is the Department of Energy and the Environment and USGS getting what they need. I just want to, from a Maryland perspective, get a sense for the, I hope, good coordination and cooperation on the tributaries sediment.
I think Deb can speak to that directly, but
we have been meeting with MDE basically. I think when we had a car meeting, I think we had Montgomery County so we are discussing, and most of the studies have been designed has been in collaboration, taking into consideration all the viewpoints. So I think advancing a coordinated yes.
I think at this stage too, Deb, we're just...
Yeah, this is still in the planning phase, so basically the study will be implemented, so with initial update is we have now actually a gauging station established at Lower Beaver Dam Creek, brand new stuff, just happened like last month or so, okay. So we'll be monitoring, in time for a year right now, all the data, and as Mark discussed, so 1 year study and have more information one year down the line.
Anybody else? Okay, so that'll be a good segue to you, Deb. You want to use the microphone up here?
Sure. Afternoon.
I'll be talking about Kingman Island today, not the Anacostia River Sediment Project. So I'm Bill Morali, the project manager for the Anacostia River Sediment Project. So while the Kingman Island is also a part of the Anacostia River Sediment Project, but of course this is mostly talking on the land itself. So there has been some improvement that we did in the last 6 months, so we want to update in terms of the status here. So just kind of give you a perspective, there are two little mini projects here. One is just the soil piles investigation, and the other one is the asphalt removal project. So there have been like three different piles, over the course of the time that had contaminated soils came from some unknown origins. So we want to determine and confirm some of those findings to see what exactly these piles had in terms of the content, as well as what is how it, you know, it would impact basically the Kingman Island and the surrounding, you know, the, soils and water. So because this will have an impact directly on the water. So we wanted to identify, so we did some test pits, you know, as you can see from the pictures here, partially buried drums and tires and some pretty much trash, you know. So we don't know the source of this. Obviously, it's been there open for some time, so there's a lot of illegal dumping that went down for some time. So we did do the soil borings around those. The picture, what you see there, is actually one of the soil piles. So we did the soil borings around the actual pile, and then the test pits actually in the soil pile itself. So we have like 12 test pits about 10 to 25 feet deep, you know, and then the about 18 soil borings, and then we also, as part of the borings, we collected water samples from those to determine the water quality of those borings. The findings of investigation clearly showed that there had been trash spoils that had a lot of general trash, and, you know, with concrete and metals and the tires and so on and so forth. And then the soil and groundwater showed some multiple compounds that are above screening levels. So screening levels is basically established by whether or not some action needs to take place, whether or some removal or reduce the human health and environmental risks of those. Something has to be done. So there were compounds that were exceeding those. And obviously the biggest being the petroleum impacted soils, you know. So TPH, PAH is typically the compound that are you can see in trash and one of those piles there. So we said, okay, what are we going to do with these? So we evaluated some of the options as to what to do with these piles here. So as you see, there are three different options here. One is just pure excavation and offsite disposal. So, and then the second one is just sorting the material on site, so to minimize the actual disposal cost. So this will be a little more expensive than the other one. And the third one is actually you can treat it on site, which is the partial excavation with on site solidification and stabilization. So what you're doing here is basically mixing lime and some sort of a compound to minimize impact. So you're consolidating the sediment, so there is no leaching in effect. So you can put it back, then, you know, correct, right. But again, that's an expensive simply because you have to deal with, you know, so much on-site remedial action. So, and then we also saw this asphalt pad. I think something Director Wells definitely, you know, suggested that we need to do something about this. So we looked at it, and since this is a pretty active Kingman Island, and a lot of activities go on with living classrooms, you know, being actually with the kids, and plus, you know, with all the concerts that are going on. So we wanted to make sure that it kind of meets with the actual plan that we have for the Kingman Island future plans. So we removed the asphalt pad, which is about 25,000 square feet. So you're just seeing the pictures of the pad removal. And then we restored the area with the, you know, with the meadow grass, with the topsoil. So whatever the asphalt that was removed, you know, it went to the recycling facility. And then the crush run that was there underneath the sub base, that was reused on the road actually to improve the road conditions at Kingman Island. So this is what you see there, the crush run being used. So. And then where there were test pits dug, you know, we kind of made it a little more prettier there, you know, with more green space and picnic benches, you know, to allow, you know, living classrooms to enjoy their time there. So. This is kind of a green project simply because everything that we saw there, you know, is kind of a taken care at the site itself, you know, not, you know, other than the asphalt that was removed and recycled, everything else that was redistributed, you know, on site there. So since this is a reduced the area for the vertical permeability, you know, permeability of the soil, so we are allowing more water to infiltrate rather than to kind of a runoff. So this is kind of that's where the storm water retention periods come into play. So we
because we are reducing the actual area, not permeable area, impermeable area. So that's all the questions. This is the last picture. You know, you see the area, you know, that went from the actual asphalt pack to the, you know, area that's now, hopefully in the next 6 months, we'll see more greener, you know.
Thank you. Great job, Ross.
Yep.
Questions, sir? Please, Ralph. Comments? Great number,
question, yeah. How much asphalt still remains on King Island?
Nothing, 25 miles back.
Oh, it's all been removed.
It's all been removed. It's all green spaces. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. But the underlying gravel in that. And the meadow is still there.
No, that thing was, that's what we used it for.
Some of it's still there.
Some of it's still there under the meadow, right?
Yeah, but I think.
They just covered it with the dirt. I mean, which is, I don't, it's great.
Whatever we are able to see there, everything is gone now. You won't see any asphalt there. We don't see any more asphalt.
Oh, no, not the asphalt.
Well, you're talking about the crushed rock, which you experienced when you tried to put the sign, the poles in, so that people don't walk all over the meadow yet,
yeah,
as we meadow it,
yeah,
that you notice when you put those poles in.
Yeah.
They use quite a bit of it, as you know, on reconditioning the road,
yeah,
but my understanding is there's still some in there.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense to remove it.
Yeah. No, because it's all a good,
yeah,
you know, sub-based
good
material. It's a good construction material, so that's what we did, you know, fix up some of the roads, you know, and puddles.
So is it a pretty good conclusion that when they created the islands, they did it so long ago that when they dredged the river, there really wasn't a lot of contaminants at that point in the river bottom that would lead to you to find a lot of this background contamination in the island, subsoil, or not?
Well, the thing is, if you remember, I know most of the thing that came from the Anacostia River are dredged sediments.
Right.
But also, there were a lot of illegal dumping. Now, over the course of the time, everything kind of leaches out, and then sooner or later you can find it. You know? So that's what we are seeing some of the, in the test pits too.
For a long time, I'll be able to dump it on
this. Correct. You know, with time, so it will have an impact on the infection.
Yeah, back here.
Yes, sir.
Deb, Living Classrooms is taking literally thousands of kids out on that island, getting them out in the marshes, catching fish, and things like that. Have you taken into consideration the particularly critical exposure areas?
Yeah, I think those soil piles, what I discussed was basically, we have discussed the options here. I guess the next step is, you know, we have to see how we can fund those study to actually remove the soils, you know, using any of those three different options that I laid out. So that is the next step.
Bill, you may want to review the report that Deb is talking about. And what I'll tell you is that it's not as bad as you'll find in other parts of the city, like Kenilworth. But because as Mayor Williams noted, is that the base underneath, there's never been a gas station there or other things like that. But that these mounds, which will cost a lot to remove, the few mounds there did not get removed. They mitigated them some, but those remain. And for the most part, I don't think kids interact with that. But in terms of the asphalt, so we can put a meadow there and absorb water.
I just know that, among other things, that the Living Classroom would like to put some education buildings on some of that land. So not necessarily the land you're looking at. I just want to make sure that that's all being coordinated, so we're not.
Oh, we are working with Living Classrooms for this project and anything that goes on in kids.
Great,
thanks.
Okay. David, you're up. As David comes up to the microphone, I want to note that as all of you know, he's our new general counsel. Not completely new anymore, but David was spent his career with the U.S. Coast Guard for Gwynne Venable, and certainly has brought a wealth of experience that's quite helpful.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here. I'm joined by Casey Padgett, who's senior counsel with the Office of the Solicitor and the Department of the Interior. And Casey and his group have been working quite extensively with us on the legal side on a lot of the issues that we'll talk about now. So glad to have Casey up here joining us. We're going to give you a little bit of a little different than we've done in the past, where we've discussed particular issues, but specifically address kind of a legal overview. And we're going to talk a little bit about the partnership between DOE and the National Park Service and the Department of the Interior, the consultative work group process, and the publicly available information. Department of the Interior and the National Park Service and DOE have been jointly working on the sediment project for a long time. There's joint technical teams, there's joint communication teams, and there's joint legal teams. And essentially the joint legal team effort is to deal with enforcement against potentially responsible parties. To fund essentially the cleanup that's going to be identified in the feasibility study and the record of decision as to what needs to be done, that needs to be funded. And that's under CERCLA, paid for by potentially responsible parties or responsible parties.
Tommy mentioned that, and I think everyone knows, the bed of the river is owned by the United States. It's under the administrative jurisdiction of the National Park Service. And for that reason, the National Park Service has the President's CERCLA cleanup and enforcement authority. Most of you are familiar with EPA exercising that authority of private sites, but on federal property, the federal agency with jurisdiction over the property has the same cleanup and enforcement authority as EPA has at private facilities. So that's the role that the Park Service is playing in this project.
My clicker stopped working here, so I can't go to the next slide, unfortunately.
You should be able to do it with the keyboard.
Oh, either way. In terms of the joint enforcement, it includes issuing information requests. This is to develop evidence to support the allocation or appropriation negotiations and to deal with cost recovery litigation. We're reviewing the potentially responsible party search materials. This is hundreds of thousands of pages of material that are going to be essentially obtained. To a certain extent, a lot of it's already been obtained, but there's much more to be obtained through information requests under CERCLA to entities that we believe may be responsible parties. And in negotiating with the potentially responsible parties, including members of the consultative working group. DOE and Department of the Interior have identified parties who may have responsibility for the river contamination. These parties include, and these are the members of the consultative working group, PEPCO, the Department of the Navy, DC Water, Washington Gas, and the District of Columbia right now. This list could be expanded. As it says, additional parties may be added in the future. There's been one meeting today to start kind of the kickoff in September, the next meeting's in November, the consultative working group. I want to emphasize this is not a decision-making body. They don't make any decisions with regard to how the river is going to be remediated or anything else. It's an information sharing exercise that hopefully will lead to a number of settlements with a number of parties, beginning with a lot of members of the consultative working group. The main purposes of the consultative working group are to coordinate efforts to identify additional PRPs, to provide a forum for sharing technical information and viewpoints. We've done a lot of work with the government and DOI, DC and the DOI have done a lot of work to date in these efforts having to do with the needle investigation and the feasibility study and so forth, but many of these parties have done work also, and so there's an opportunity to get additional information that's presented by their participation in the consultative working group. And it's to initiate kind of a two-step approach to allocating costs. There's the administrative side, which is leading to the record of decision, and those costs are kind of known. But then there's a second phase, which is essentially establishing what allocation or apportionment is going to apply to each one of the responsible parties in terms of the remedial cost and the natural resource damages. As I said, the first meeting was held in September, the next meeting is in November, and there's going to be additional meetings scheduled over the coming months. Publicly available information. Documents obtained via the information request will be made available on a web page for the public. So as we collect this information, it's going to be made available to the public. This improves transparency. It also assists with the PRP negotiations. In many cases, if we find information and the parties become aware of it, then we have essentially an opportunity to then enter into negotiations with them on settlement of any claims or cost recovery that we are entitled to. The information, as I said, is useful to all the parties in expediting the allocation negotiations. And DOE will maintain an administrative record file, which includes all of the technical settlement project documents. And this is the website for those who are interested. There's who we are. And does anybody have any questions?
Lisa.
So you mentioned the natural resource damages.
So be sure everybody can hear you.
Sorry. You mentioned the natural resource damages.
Oh, you have to press. It's working. Yeah, you have to press.
Determining who is going to be the lead as between frankly, DOE doesn't have a lot of experience in that area. NOAA and DOI have, and so we're starting to talk to them about basically establishing the Trustees Council. That process has started. It's just not we haven't done anything yet other than just start that process. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
So at the risk asking, I'm going to project. So how does what you're doing coordinate with what we heard earlier about the remedial investigation and the feasibility study and leading to the record decision in June? Are these parallel tracks? Are they coordinated?
To a certain extent. Obviously the feasibility study is going to determine what remedial actions are possible, and then the record of decision is going to determine what the remedial actions are going to be. Those all have costs. The cost of the remedial investigation, the feasibility study, and the record of decision is kind of like, we were talking about this two-phase approach to allocation of costs. Hopefully we can recover or recoup some of those costs because they're knowable. In the future, until the record of decision and the determination is made as to how what remediation actions are the best in terms of determining how we're going to clean up the river and what remedial actions are the ones that are selected. That comes later, and right now it's unknowable, but we're starting the process, as you can see, of identifying. We know to a certain extent who the players are in some instances. The effort to determine the PRP search is to determine who else is out there and who else may be accountable for the type of contaminants. I mean, as we do the remedial investigation, we determine the type of contaminants that are out there that are impacting the riverbed and the tributaries. And then essentially that who had those type of contaminants is part of the question. And then when they had them and how they got to the river, where they wind up is the fate and transport aspect of it. It's kind of a parallel process, but it's also they inform each other, if you will.
And just to add on to that, as Director Wells indicated at the beginning, the Park Service and DOEE have formed this partnership. We refer to it as a three legs of the stool of the partnership. The first being close coordination on the technical side. Remedial investigation feasibility study that Mark spoke about. The second is close coordination on the enforcement side. And the third is coordination on the community outreach, community involvement piece of it. And as Dave indicated, the enforcement piece and the technical piece are moving on parallel tracks with the ultimate goal of the enforcement piece to be to make sure that when we have a remedy selected and we're ready to implement, we will have the resources to do that.
Walter, it's very important that Appleseed understands this clearly. So did that explain it? Or?
Yeah. Can I just follow up, though? If your work went spectacularly, is it possible that by the time you got to the June 18 decision, you would already know how your PRP work has developed and the resources are going to be there to actually implement the record of decision?
That's the goal.
Okay.
And if our efforts work spectacularly, we may actually accomplish that.
Great. Okay.
As you know, I think everybody in this room knows when you're talking about a remedy, we don't know, as Dave said, we don't know what the cost of the remedy will actually be, but I think it's safe to assume it will be a very high number. When you're talking about that kind of money, it takes a lot of work to come up with a settlement that provides that kind of money. So that's why we started already, but it's going to be a difficult process. But the goal is to have the resources available as soon as possible once the remedy is done.
Go for it.
Yes.
So are there PRPs that were invited to participate that declined to be part of the work group?
Yes.
So we would have to request that information, or can we do a written request to find out? Is that something that would be available? Just out of curiosity.
No, I mean basically, we requested CSX to participate. They haven't to date. I mean, that may change.
And so, just to be clear, we went after the major obvious ones, included CSX, and now that they can use this process, it's incumbent on these PRPs to see who else had chain of ownership for this land, and they can help through the inquiry process get that information. So there will be more added.
Yeah. No, you guys were great in the beginning with, you know, kind of telling us who you were going after, so it just seems like a surprisingly short list to me. But understandable, I guess.
And as Dave indicated, you know, we are actively working to expand the list through the information requests that will be going out through the PRP search. And in my experience, it's not uncommon for PRPs to use the expression "lie in the weeds" until there's enough reason for them to be motivated to come up and participate. And that's the goal going forward, is through one means or another we'll bring more parties to the table. And that's really critical in terms of slicing the pie, if you will, allocating total costs. You need to know how big the pie is. You need to know how many people are at the table who each deserve a share. And then you need to know what each party's relative share is.
There's kind of a question in a project of this nature, because you have this issue of what they call allocation, and you have this question of apportionment, and it depends on what the harm is, whether it's the visible harm or indivisible harm. And as you saw, there's certain areas and off on tributaries where, I mean, that arm may be divisible and that party may be subject to an apportionment as opposed to an allocation, which some one of the judges in a case analyzed it to you're sitting down at dinner at a restaurant and you bring a check that's basically for the whole group, and then you know that's and then you determine you know kind of what's fair between them. That's allocation as opposed to the people at the table getting separate bills to begin with. That's apportionment, and it really comes down to the harm. And so I mean to a certain extent, this consultative working group is an attempt to try and work with companies who and the companies that we invited to participate or the entities that we invited to participate had in the past exhibited you know a willingness to work with us. I mean CSX entered into a consent order with us on issues associated with their Benning Road yard or their Benning yard, and so this is an attempt to kind of try and deal with some of those issues, maybe get settlements going early to the point where we'll have some money to keep the project going and once the ROD is entered and the remediation is determined, remediation actions is determined, then we'll have the ability to start right away on that. So, yes?
Reinforce a point I made earlier, and it's just for this one, I applaud the effort. I think it's a great effort to try to get the PRPs in a dialogue as we move forward, that the construct of making of a peer-reviewed models dealing with fate and transport issues, etc., in my opinion, is very fundamental to a successful outcome here.
All right, we agree.
Can I just ask one other thing, just to clarify? My understanding is that the Office of the D.C. Attorney General is also involved in this issue and yes. May have engaged outside counsel. Is that a different track, or are they part of what you are doing?
We're working with OAG just as
okay.
They have to work with their DOJ. I mean, in terms of any litigation issues that arise, we have to work together.
Walter, I know you were involved in talking to us about that earlier. We invited you in, and we're happy to give you a much more in-depth briefing on what that means.
Okay.
Because it's a lot more layers, but yes, we're all
okay.
In it now.
Okay. I'd like to do that.
Good.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Suppose there was a business that was a possible party that contributed to the pollution of the river. It no longer exists. There are no heirs to it. How does that factor into the allocation of costs of the cleanup of the river?
Well, it means that there's more for the other parties to bear.
So it's prorated based on they're not there as a responsible party
that's,
to bear in that cost.
That's an issue that will come up in negotiations. It's an issue that will come up in litigation if there is litigation. You know, some parties will argue that it's an orphan share, to use EPA's term, the common term, and make an argument as to who should bear the burden of that work in there. Other parties will argue that it gets allocated across the parties who are at the table in the same proportion to whatever their relative responsibility is.
And then for an instance, and I'm just going to play strictly hypothetical, I think I'm stating this right, in the case of a transfer of federal properties to the District of Columbia, and I'll use Poplar Point as the example, I think that's occurred. It has not yet, so it's still... And what agency oversees that particular... Is that National Park Service, or is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Poplar Point, in particular, is managed by the National Park Service. It is subject to legislation directing for the Park Service and the district to effectuate the transfer. That hasn't happened yet. I think, from a CERCLA enforcement perspective, it's not terribly significant whether it's happened or when it happens. To anticipate the question.
Right, so if the land is transferred, it doesn't become the district's responsibility for that prorated share of the cleanup of that site or the damage to the river.
Well, you know, I think
remain with the federal government.
There's sort of two answers to that question. From a legal standpoint, the current owner of property is a PRP, but from an equitable standpoint and the allocation process, if the current owner did absolutely nothing to contribute to the contamination, their argument would be effectively they shouldn't bear any responsibility.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks.
Okay. My good friend Carlton Ray, Anacostia River Town. Welcome,
so much. Good afternoon. I'm Carlton Ray. I'm the director of Clean Rivers Project for BC Water. It's an honor to be here. Mayor, I'm so glad to be with you here. And then Director Wells. Director Wells and I, I'm a great admirer of Mr. Wells for 364 days a year, except one day. And that one day is when Director Wells cheers for his alma mater, the University of Alabama, and I cheer for Auburn University. So other than that, I'm very much honored to be here, and I appreciate it. So today we're going to talk about the Anacostia River Tunnel System, and it's pretty amazing what's going on. So the overview, as y'all know, many of y'all know, we have an old combined sewer system that's been around since the 1800s. It was originally designed to transport both sanitary sewage and stormwater ultimately to the river, but somewhere there, late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a pipe that was extended down toward the southern part of the district, and ultimately Blue Plains was constructed early in this century. But it was designed, the focus at the time was, let's capture all the dry weather sewage and treat that, and then and try to capture as much wet weather water as, but whatever gets away from it and ends up in the Anacostia. And so because of that, you can see this is a discharge CSO-17 near one of the district boathouse boat areas that basically raw sewage overflows into the river. A tremendous amount of trash comes into the Anacostia from the CSOs. And this is up by the CSX bridge. Just speaking of CSX, it's near CSX bridge. We have one of the CSOs up there. Also, we have this tremendous problem up in the northeast part of the district. It's been in the 1800s as well. There was a northeast boundary sewer that was constructed in 1894. That was constructed from Florida Avenue down to the Anacostia River to transport stormwater and sewage, but primarily stormwater, to the Anacostia River. Even at that time, it was undersized, and as you know, developments occurred over the years, and more problems with floodings occurred up in the Bloomingdale-LaDroite Park area, as you all, most of your district residents know about. I'm so sorry. And so we came up with a plan and worked with, I know John Capacasa is on the phone, and we worked with his team and developed a plan, a long-term control plan, as you see in front of us here. The pink line is a large tunnel system that will capture 98% of the sewage that's currently going, CSO that's currently going to the Anacostia. One of the highest capture rates in the country. For example, in Philadelphia, they're around 50%. Their green infrastructure program is around 50%. We're at 98%. So DC, we expect higher. We're going to get higher. So very, very, very high capture rate. On the Potomac, you see we modified that this past year. We initially had a large pump station we planned to build up by the Lincoln Memorial. We now have a gravity system that yellow line is now a tunnel that it's connected at the JBAB shaft, the Joint Base Anacostia Bowling, and serves the area around Kennedy Center. And so sewage that currently overflows at that location will now overflow into the yellow line or that tunnel system and flow all the way down to the southern part of the district, where we pump that water up and recycle that water into the Potomac. A whole lot cleaner than what's going on right now. And then we also modified by put some green infrastructure up in Rock Creek. We had a 9.5 million gallon tunnel that we planned to build up in Piney Branch. We eliminated that, and our approach is to install green infrastructure, 365 acres from previous acres of green infrastructure in lieu of that, and also some green infrastructure of the Potomac area as well. If it doesn't work, we have a project number one this next 5 years. If it doesn't work, we go back to the tunnel system into the Piney Branch and go back to extending that yellow line all the way up into the CNO Canal. We're in it to make it win. We have a really good program, real good project team, both for the tunnel team as well as for the green infrastructure team, and we're moving forward aggressively with both programs. This is basically a tunnel or mock-up or schematic of our tunnel system. Instead of having the sewage overflow directly into the Anacostia, we're building shafts parallel to those sewer outfalls. We drop the sewage down into the tunnel and then through an added into the tunnel system itself. We designed this, each one of these, we designed to minimize air entrainment. So it actually, when the water falls down the shaft, it goes in a spherical motion and goes into a plunge pool. We want the tunnel system to transport water, sewage, not air. And so we designed each one of these. We worked with the University of Iowa and the University of Michigan to develop mock-ups for each of these shafts. And we're doing quite well on the construction of those.
Why don't you want air?
Yes, sir?
Why don't you want air?
Oh, excuse me. Why we don't air is basically what happens if you have tremendous air bubbles getting into the tunnel system, you'll have geysers effect. Basically, it'll shoot out 200, 300 feet out of there.
You don't want air bubbles.
The fine folks in the Navy Yard don't want that.
There's nothing like balance. Okay, so here we go. Want to
try this? So basically, I had a Google flyover over the tunnel alignment for the Anacostia tunnel. It starts down at Navy Yard, it starts down here by National Harbor at Blue Plains and flies up all the way up 13 miles to the northeast part of the district. So this tunnel system, again, will capture stormwater that's currently causing flooding to occur up in Bloomingdale and LaJoy Park, convey that down, also capture the, what I was telling you about, the raw sewage, combined sewage that's currently going to Anacostia, 98% of it, and allow that to go all the way down to Blue Plains to recycle the water. We treat that water, we pump it up and recycle the water as well. This is the tunnel project. We break these projects up to various size projects for for funding purposes. This first one, the Blue Plains Tunnel, is complete. It's highlighted in red. That's up by near National Stadium for the Win the World Series this year. But basically, that allows flow to come down to Blue Plains. The Anacostia Tunnel, we're constructing right now. We're underneath, or approximately underneath the green line with that one. The Northeast Boundary Tunnel is currently in procurement, somewhere between $500-600 million project. And the First Street Tunnel, which was planned to be constructed later in the process, we went ahead and constructed it now after we had the tremendous floods in 2012. And we put in a small pump station down here at the lower end of that to basically act as a large cistern that provides about 10 million gallons of storage at that location. Currently, those fine folks, every time it gets a 2 or 3 year storm event, they have flooding that occurs. We want to divert that water into the tunnel. Ultimately, we're going to make that connection, and so a drop of water that flows into the Bloomingdale area will come all the way down and get recycled at the Blue Plains Tunnel site. This is just the cross-sectional view. We go through primarily clay. We're about 120 feet below the ground. We go underneath the Potomac River, the Anacostia River. Like I said, we're underneath 11th Street Bridge. We mined under 11th Street Bridge. We mined underneath. We're currently going under the Green Line from Metro all the way up to the Northeast part of the district. This is just a schematic of the diversion structure that would drop the flow down into the tunnel. So this is the first tunnel that we constructed. Again, we're complete with that. It was a $330 million project. We brought it in under budget. Not a lot of multi-billion dollar programs that can say that. We brought it in under at $318 million, and we brought it on a schedule. It's currently, it's been nominated project for the national, but we've got the Mid-Atlantic region for 2016 Engineering News Record Award. We also had 1.6 million work hours, man hours, without a lost time incident on the project. And we had, of the $318 million we spent on it, well over $110 million went to MBE-WBE firms. So very proud of that, for that work. You say it's a good project for us. The next one's the Anacostia Tunnel. We're mining from the RFK site. So if you look at RFK in the southwest corner, you'll see those cranes down there. That's where we're mining from. We built two shafts with a small interconnecting tunnel between them. The lower shaft is where we lowered Nanny after Nanny Helen Burroughs. Amazing tunnel boring machine. She's a football field and a half long. And again, we're about right here. We're about to, somebody was reaching Poplar Point. We have a shaft where we constructed Poplar Point. We'll be pulling Nanny out toward the end of November and December timeframe. Again, she's done a marvelous job, and we're on schedule with her. 81% complete. And again, that one's a tagging firm, Sleeney and Pajilo, is doing the work for us. We have some of the best tunneling companies in the world going after our work. We feel like we're a fair owner. And also, we have a good team that's working with the contractors on it. Yes, sir.
So everybody understands the machine, as it bores through the clay, it's actually boring. Pulling out on a conveyor belt all the material and mining the tunnel.
That's right.
Same machine. It's really amazing.
That's right.
Down there.
That's right. That's right. This one's the tunnel that we constructed up at First Street. I was telling you that we originally planned to construct this in 2025, but we went to decide to go ahead and build it now because it provided like a large cistern, large underground storage for sewage. To temporarily hold that sewage and then pump it into the existing system when the storm cell passes. It doesn't solve the problem. It reduces the probability of flooding up there, but ultimately, when we construct the Northeast Boundary Tunnel, this big tunnel, and make that connection, that will ultimately solve the majority of the flooding. If we do have Matthew that hits us, Hurricane Matthew, we'll still have flooding up in that area, but Majority of the flooding will no longer be an issue. They used to have, it's kind of interesting, you go back in the history books, from about 1950s on, they had these storms that could pop up every 2 or 3 years up there. And so there were these 5 and 6 year studies that would be developed, and with a couple million dollars here, spent a couple hundred million, or a couple million dollars there, spent over the years, so maybe $10 or $15 million over the years trying to solve that problem. But ultimately, we needed something like this to solve the flooding problem. It's such a big issue, and it was it was designed back in the 1800s, undersized then. And it's just magnified over the years, the problem's magnified. But the fine folks, these folks have been great to work with. I mean, they've put up with a lot. And obviously, they've had a lot of sewage rolling in their basements. They're fed up with that, and we get it. I understand that. But they also worked with us the last couple of years to build this facility. You can see that we're up against houses, and really a great project for us. We're just about complete. The mine's been complete. It's been serviceable. We've been able to use it during a storm, a couple of storm events. But well, we're basically here toward the end of October finishing the whole project. And then, let's see, I'm sorry. I did the Northeast Boundary Tunnel. This big, large tunnel is 27,000 lineal feet, so being the largest project in the history of DC Water, one of the largest projects on the East Coast, somewhere between about $600 million that we'll be spending on that project. We have 4 design build teams that we're currently working through procurement with. Some of the best folks in the world working on the program on our side as well as on the contractor side. So it's really a good project for us. So I have another video. I don't know, is it going to work, you think? I was trying to show what that actually looks like. Is that right? So you have to visualize it. So the mayor was talking about this. So what we do, this football field that has the long tunnel, it's like a factory underground. And we're mining, we mine 6 feet and we stop. And when we stop, we basically pulling the muck out, pulling the material out, and we have a conveyor belt that pulls it all the way back to the shaft. Right now, the one on the Anacostia Tunnel is pulling out back about 10,000 feet. So that conveyor belt is 10,000 feet backwards, a couple miles backwards, but it also has another couple miles coming back the other way. So it's 4 miles of conveyor belt system that's continuously running, pulling material out, and then we dump it to an upland site. We work with the Corps of Engineers for either like it's great landfill material or strip mine material, that type of stuff. We can't put in wetlands. So if you got wetlands, don't come talk to me. We're not interested in filling in wetlands. But basically, so we mine, and then as the mayor said, we stop, and then we have 7 precast sections that we install. And the fellows, the men and women do this unbelievable job. They pick up these segments. They're 10, 12,000 pound segments, 14 inches thick. They're 6 feet wide, about 10 feet, 8 feet this way, and basically put 8 or 7 segments, including a keystone, in to make a ring of tunnel, and it's really a fabulous process. So we continue to do that. We work 24 hours a day. We have 3 shifts. Down when we're mining, we don't really care about whether it's raining up top or whether it's sunny or snowing. We keep mining. And so we mine 5 days a week and sometimes on 6 days a week. We take a break on Sunday. This is just a conveyor belt system. Pull the buck out. This is what the mayor was talking about. We have we're mining up here. On the other side is that cutter wheel. These are basically thrusting rods or piston rods. Those are periodically pulled back, and we install a segment and go all the way around and install 7 segments to make a ring of tunnel. These are the precast segments that we're constructing down in Brandywine, Wine, Maryland. I just want to talk about this. You know, we talk billions of dollars and love, and sometimes we get lost there that our ratepayers are paying for this. And so 22 cents on the dollar of every dollar is coming toward DC Water is going to our Clean Rivers project. And I'm really, I want to thank, if you're a district ratepayer, thank you very much for the help supporting the program. Again, our water and sewer bills, since I've gotten here, we started out with this impervious area charge at zero, and we're now at $25 a month. And so the folks, it's going right on up. It'll continue to go up for the next 15 years. And again, it's a costly issue, costly program. Our ratepayers have done a marvelous job. We are trying to look at ways to continue to look at ways to reduce the burden on our low-income folks. George and George Hawkins and the team, Mark, Kim, have done marvelous ways, looking at ways to reduce the cost of this, but still it's a lot of money. And the overall program is $2.6 billion. Like I said, we're on schedule, we're on budget. That first work to RFK Stadium, so the Blue Plains Tunnel, the Anacostia Tunnel, and all those other things, all the other projects below the RFK Stadium has to be completed by March of 2018, and we're on schedule to get that done. And then the rest of the work has to be completed by 2025. We're on accelerate the Northeast Boundary Tunnel to have that completed by 2023. So all that work that you saw there on the Anacostia is about $1.8 billion. And it's a lot of money, and but at the same time, we're very proud that we're both on schedule as well as on budget. So glad to talk, capture any questions you might have. Yes, sir.
Two questions. One, do you have any idea of how much green infrastructure went into the First Street project?
Yeah, so I talked about the First Street Tunnel. Just north of that is Irving Street. We put in a little less than $3 million for the green infrastructure along Irving Street that captures about 400,000 gallons of water. So if you, where I was showing you First Street, where McMillan Reservoir is, just to the north of that, that runs east-west Irving Street, that's where we've installed a good deal of green infrastructure. DDOT put in a little bit of green infrastructure down Rhode Island. I apologize, I don't know the amount. Relatively small, but I don't know what the amount was.
And follow up, second question. In reference to the ratepayers and the efforts to reduce the amount for low-income residents.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any idea of some of the kinds of things that you said are being done to affect that?
Yeah, so I'm really not the right person to talk about that. I feel like George and the CFO could do a much better job on that. I know that the energy, if they get and get a acknowledgement that they can get the low energy supplement, what is that called, Director?
LIHEAP.
Yeah, so basically we respect the same thing, and they can get a discount. If they don't have to come in and show that they are their books or in their taxes or anything, if they basically apply and get approved by DOEE for a subsidy on energy, they can do the same thing for us as well.
Ben?
So you hold down the button and the microphone works.
So I had a question.
Too late.
In the spirit of clean energy, was there ever at any point in the design of this amazing subterranean interstate highway system for water, the inclusion of micro turbines to generate electricity from the flow of the high volumes of sewage and stormwater?
We haven't as of yet. We've thought about it, and it's certainly there is energy there. There's definitely energy for us to capture.
Is it possibly something that could be an add-on to this?
Yes, I think so. Yes, yeah. Right. Those shafts,
Those are fairly large shafts that we constructed, and we believe we put in some turbines or something like that to catch that energy.
I was going to say, just to add, that's actually something we're looking on the water side and perhaps in other areas of the conveyance system. With the Clean Rivers tunnels, we're hoping that they actually will not be filled as often as maybe given wet weather events. So there really might not be as much energy in there as there could be in other parts of the system. But it's definitely something that we're looking into.
Yes, ma'am.
Now that I know how this works.
What do you do with the trash? How do you manage the trash?
Yeah, so we're capturing, because that flow is coming down the shaft, we're capturing majority, if not all of it, into our system. We estimate two times a year that we may have flow get away from us on an average year. We even think we may be a little bit higher than that capture rate. So all that trash will come down. We have a screening device we have two shafts we've constructed down at Blue Plains. The first shaft will be for screening purposes and capturing that trash, capturing logs, whatever that might fall into our combined sewer system. And then we pull it up with a clamshell and dispose of it at that location.
I want to respect everyone's time. No, that was great, Charleston. Thank you very much. Even without videos. So I want to respect everyone's time. So any announcements? Let me start with Jeff. I believe you have an announcement for us.
Sure. We mentioned trash. Now we're having a signing of a regional report next Thursday, for those that haven't heard it. It's really just to memorialize all the great collaboration that's going on between Prince George's, Montgomery County District to specifically address the trash issue in the Anacostia watershed and restore the Anacostia. So that's at 10 o'clock in the morning. It's Thursday. The invitation will go out either today or tomorrow. And be happy to see as many faces as folks in the room participate as possible.
So County Executive Leggett and County Executive Baker will be there along with the mayor. And it's signing your an agreement and pledge around trash, and this is facilitated by the Alice Ferguson Foundation. And everyone will get a invitation, and you're welcome to bring somebody, and that will be a town talk on Thursday, correct?
That's right. It's
where?
In Anacostia Park, at the Aquatic Research Education Center is right in Anacostia Park.
Anacostia Park at the AREP Center. Lisa?
Just to elaborate on that, been a great journey, and I'm glad we're at this point. I want to give my kudos. Thank you. I want to give my kudos to the Anacostia Riverkeeper and Jim and others. The idea of the executives going on a boat tour of the Anacostia, in the sense of becoming ambassadors for that. Please, Frank. When any of us go on the Anacostia with all the tours you give us and the tremendous amount of progress, especially on the upland side that has been made on the Anacostia, there's a lot more work to be done, but it really is a tremendous amount of progress. So I just want to reinforce the importance of us all being ambassadors to the Anacostia. I think it's really great.
To reiterate, we have the Anacostia Riverkeeper, Anacostia Watershed Society, funded through our stormwater funds, are providing free tours on the Anacostia River. They've got great boats for this. So, Walter, I don't know if your board has been, but if you've got a board of directors or if you have a group, then just to kind of reintroduce them to the river. These are great tours, and our tour boat leaders do a narrative all along the way. It's really been, I think, far more successful than I ever imagined, Jeff, where you guys have done a great job in envisioning this. Any other announcements? One last one, Bob, Bill?
Yeah. The Citizens Advisory Committee is one of the supporters of a Festival del Rio as part of our Hispanic awareness efforts. It will be held from 11 to 4 on the 15th at Bladensburg Marina. And there will be a great many different displays attracting people. Also, the Citizens Advisory Committee has been talking about this wonderful set of cooperative efforts, but we also have noticed that probably the main effort in the country along these lines in the Hudson River has come a cropper, that the job was worked on for 7 years, that EPA announced it was complete and successful. The next week, NOAA announced that it was not successful, and their scientific study showed that it was going to take 40 years to get the fish back, not five, at which point the Department of Environmental Conservation in New York State attacked EPA. We are thinking of inviting somebody to our Citizen Advisory Committee meeting from the Hudson River to explain exactly how all this fell apart, because we think there might be some lessons. And we would be happy to arrange that visit at a time convenient to all of you for a meeting here, if you think that might be kind of an interesting add-on.
Okay. All right, everybody. Thank you very much. Very full meeting. Very informative.
Mr. Ram, do you put it back to Lupe?
Yeah, I did. Oh, it's good to see the next one here.
Yes, sir.
And you too. Well, yeah. How about seeing you?
Tommy, I'll follow up with you about that, okay?
Exactly. You're like, this is my belly. There's no way. Like, what? And then it freezes the whole thing. I can't remember what I was doing, but it was something similar, and it just, like, whoa.
I'll just email you, and we'll find a good time to set it up, okay? Thank you.
I'm going to go to the next one. This started as a board member, but it turns out you and Eric are the only ones.
Sir, did you ever get this?
Hello. Where are you going to go?
Well, and I still, I saw her this past Friday. She was it's the other thing.
Yes, River Front Lake. Sure, I'll meet you outside. Carlton, how are you?
Nice meeting you.